Welcome back. In today's episode, we continue our conversation with Dr. Heisel on the topic of suicide prevention in older adults. And so you developed these meaning-centered men's groups. It's a community-based intervention designed to foster the mental health and well-being of men transitioning into retirement. So can you describe how these groups promote or foster a sense of resiliency in dealing with this life transition?
Yeah, we developed them theoretically based on the work of Viktor Frankl, who was an Austrian neurologist and psychiatrist, best known for his book, Man's Search for Meaning, which really is a meaning-centered or meaning-oriented form of psychotherapy. And so taking a page from his book, almost literally, we recognize that there are a variety of areas in which people tend to find meaning. So when asked, he said, you know, people often find meaning in creativity, which he defined as that which we give to the world. Often that's through our work, but it can also be through artistic creation. It can be through our recreational pastimes that we do that contribute to others, including volunteering, mentoring, etc. But he also said there's also the flip side. We find meaning through that which we give to the world, but we also find meaning through that which we receive from the world around us. And that can be through our experiences. It can be relationships, love, experiences in life. It can be through beauty. It can be through enjoyment of the arts and sports and various other things. But he then said we also find meaning through the attitudes that we take towards the experiences that we have in life. So having a particular experience, it could be a loss. We tend to think of losses as negatives, but we can also see them as opportunities or challenges to overcome. And that often the difference in how we respond emotionally to a particular experience in life has to do with the attitude that we take towards it. So you can take a positive experience like, you know, you win a lottery and you might think, wow, most people would just be absolutely thrilled with that. And then they might say, yeah, but I only won $1,000 and someone else won $50 million. What sort of win is that? If I'm only going to win once, I've just lost $1,000. Who cares about? So, you know, you can take a very positive experience and see it negatively. You know, somebody, you know, you're walking down the aisle or you're walking down a hallway at work. Your boss says hello to you. You could say, did you see the way he said hello to me? He obviously thinks I'm not working very hard. You know, I heard an assumption in that. Like, what are you doing away from your desk? Or your most recent report was no good. So, you know, where somebody else can say, what are you talking about? He said hi to you. He acknowledged you. That's a good thing. So the attitude and the perspective that we take towards a given experience has a large impact on how we experience it emotionally. And this is really something that the cognitive therapists really focused on. But Frankl did as well and said that really the attitudes we take towards both the positives in life as well as negative experiences or adversity can be meaningful in and of themselves, and that we can learn something from both the most positive as well as the most negative experiences, and we can grow from it. We can find meaning even in suffering. So he frequently would quote Nietzsche in saying, he who has a why to live for, we should say one who has a why to live for, or they who have a why to live for, something meaningful to live for, can overcome almost anyhow. Essentially saying, no matter what you face in life, if you're able to find something meaningful in it, you can learn from it, you can persevere, you can go on, and hopefully even grow from it and grow positively rather than feel knocked down and like you're not able to overcome it. And finally, he said, we find meaning in what he called ultimate meaning, which has to do with sort of a greater sense of grand sense of purpose in life, or more of a religious or even spiritual, broadly spiritual sense of connection. So with our groups, we've oriented them. Generally, our men's groups are 12-week groups, and we spend a few weeks talking about finding meaning through creativity, through the work that one has done or still can do, through volunteerism, through recreations, through sports, pastimes, hobbies, and activities. We then move into talking about finding meaning through experiences, including relationships, and what we still can find in future experience and in future relationships. We talk about volunteering, giving back in various ways, which really resonates with a lot of people. especially for those who feel that I'm no longer working, I can no longer make a contribution. We say not so. There are a variety of contributions you can still make. And maybe now that you've got more time on your plate, you can make an even bigger contribution to society. Now we talk about attitudes towards, again, positive experiences, being a good winner, as well as a good loser, trying to find meaning in adversity, in negative experiences, and then looking towards the future, whether in a spiritual way for those who feel that, or in a non-spiritual way, but still recognizing that as long as we draw breath, we can still find meaning in life, and we can still make the world a better place for those around us. So we spend really a 12-week period focusing on that. There's a group of men going through the retirement experience, either before, during, or after, and who are still, you know, a bit concerned about it, as well as a couple of facilitators. And we really focus on this for an hour and a half to 2 hours once a week, applying some of those learnings, sharing personal experiences, as well as doing some exercises together to really focus on sort of the point of that week's discussion. But also really focusing, the other piece of it is getting the people in the group to support one another, to gel as a group, and to share the message that no matter what we're facing, it can go easier by sharing the burden with others, by developing friendships, and by recognizing, as you had intimated before, that a lot of men feel like, I've got to do this, I've got to be the one to take charge. And part of it also is, I've got to do this individually. And this is a way of saying, you're each going through this potentially challenging life transition, yet you're each doing it individually. Why don't you come together and find the strength in doing it as a group? And we found that they've worked wonderfully well. There have been extremely meaningful, extremely touching and poignant experiences in the groups, including some group members saying, you know, it feels like I've just met a number of brothers I never knew I had before. And I feel like I can always turn to this group of guys when I need to share something, when I need some advice, when I need some support. And we're actually now running our groups. We're going to be running our groups, adapting them for male military veterans and first responders, police, fire, as well as paramedics and EMTs, realizing that these are all careers that can be highly stressful, and that sense of camaraderie can be very helpful.
And also the importance of, or feeling of, mattering to others. And it's been shown that promoting that sense of mattering, that sense of contributing productively to helping others, can be so important.
Absolutely. Feeling that I'm needed, feeling that I've still got a place, that, yeah, I matter to others, that I matter to the world, that's extremely important. And I agree, it can go hand in hand. That when somebody feels that they no longer matter, they can have difficulty finding meaning, and vice versa. Whereas feeling that I can still make a meaningful contribution, even if it's not in this field, or even if it's not in my community, but it is somewhere, then it really sends a message, I still matter. And if so, there's still value in my being around and continuing to do that. I agree completely.
And Frankl discussed the sort of converse of that, which is the existential vacuum, where you are not perceiving meaning in certain life situations, and it creates a profound sense of emptiness.
Absolutely. And he said, and it's important for people to realize that questioning one's meaning in life isn't necessarily a sign of pathology or illness. It's a sign of being a thinking human being, that all human beings at some point question, you know, what's the value of all this? What am I here for? Is this, am I really leading a meaningful existence? It's an important question. It's one that philosophers, existentialists have dealt with for hundreds of years. However, if one comes to the conclusion that no, my life has no meaning, or my existence is meaningless, that I don't matter, that can lead to a profound sense of emptiness, depression, hopelessness, despair, and even suicidal thoughts or behavior. And one of the issues, he said, is when somebody comes to the conclusion that their life is empty, that they have that existential vacuum, well, vacuum tends to attract things. And so one of the things that we tend to do, as we'd sort of discussed before, people can engage in frenetic behavior and activity as a way to try and fill that inner sense of emptiness. And that can be through drinking, drugs, through sexual promiscuity, through violent behavior, through risk-taking behavior, et cetera, et cetera. Not that I'm saying that all of those things are always necessary and negative, but it's that driven sense of, I feel that there's a gaping hole inside of me, and my God, I've got to fill it up with stuff quickly so that I don't feel that inner sense of emptiness. In therapy, in psychotherapy, we'd say it's important to acknowledge and recognize that inner feeling of emptiness, try and get a sense of where that comes from, and help somebody realize, you know, more naturally and therapeutically, some of the things that are important about what you're doing to sort of reduce that sense of emptiness, and what sort of positive, healthy, proactive behavior somebody can get involved in as a way of feeling that I'm making a contribution. And in part, for some people who feel that their sense of worth is directly tied to their contribution to the workplace, you can see how all of this comes together. For somebody who feels that I'm only valuable when I make a contribution to the workplace, or because I've got a certain title, or because I make a certain amount of money, or drive a particular car, or have that corner office, or whatever the case might be, and I now no longer do, now I feel that sense of emptiness, and that can then attract all of these negative things, including potentially risky behavior, self-destructive behavior, as well as thoughts and actions towards suicide. So doing something to help people recognize their inner value, their opportunity and ability to still make contribution, even in, and maybe especially in retirement, and help them to look at their life in a different sort of way and recognize that meaning can be found in every moment of every day. It doesn't have to be something grand like, you know, a Nobel Peace Prize. Not that I'm knocking a Nobel Peace Prize. Hey, if you can get it, go for it. But nothing has to be quite as massive as that to experience meaning in life. Having, you know, a quiet time with a loved one, having conversation with somebody, playing a game, going for a walk, exercising, anything that allows somebody to access that can be very helpful.
And so the meaning-centered groups represent an upstream approach to mental health promotion and suicide prevention. Can you speak to the importance of these upstream approaches?
Absolutely. And by upstream, what we mean is, you know, farther away from suicidal behavior or death by suicide. That if we think about it, we can think of sort of a time continuum associated with risk for suicide. And sort of the absolute heightened point of risk is when somebody is about to or just about to engage in ending their life. And that, of course, if we can, we should intervene then. Often by that point, we're no longer right there. And sometimes it's just by happenstance or the grace of God that somebody happens to be passing and is able to sometimes even physically reach out and save a life. And that's an extremely important intervention and not to be minimized at all. That through a lot of what we do in clinical practice, clinical mental health practice, is when people are already struggling, already feeling loss, already feeling depressed, already feeling hopeless, so that there's a lot of sort of digging out that you've got to do. They're too absolutely essential. We need mental health providers in hospital emergency departments and urgent care centers. We need people working on telephone distress lines, both volunteer and professional lines. We need people who are able to make sort of mobile crisis visits and go out and wellness visits to somebody's home and intervene. We need people in clinics who can provide care on, you know, a weekly basis or whatnot, as well as hospital inpatient units. All of that is necessary, but that's all more downstream. And as we're thinking, and if we want to take more of a population health or public health approach, recognizing that we've got this vast population of people moving into and through their older years, where risk is somewhat higher, we've got to look at earlier interventions. And that's what we're thinking of by upstream, before risk has really accumulated, before people are at the point of feeling depressed and suicidal. What can we do to promote a sense of mental health, well-being, meaning in life, mattering, so that they don't get to that point? And that's really what we're hoping to do with these groups, to get people at a point of transition that can be a challenging point, but not where they're actively suicidal or even necessarily depressed, but there's the potential that they could become so if things continue along in a particular way. And I like also that you'd mentioned resiliency, because as we think about it, resiliency is not just sort of protection against the onset of negatives, but how well you respond to and can you bounce back from the negatives that are occurring in your life. So if we think about it either as pulling an elastic or rubber band and letting it go, it snaps back to the original shape, unless, of course, we completely break it apart. Similarly, if we push on a ball in a swimming pool, you feel a lot of pressure pushing back. You are able to push it under the water, but then when you let go, it shoots back up again. So it's that sense of resiliency or even buoyancy. And the psychological equivalent of that is somebody who's gone through a challenging life experience, who's in the process of doing so, who might feel the stress and the strain and the challenge of it, which understandably can feel difficult and can feel worrying. It can feel anxiety provoking. It can feel sad or depressing, but it doesn't have to break somebody. And the question is, you've got that stress. How do you push back on it? Can you come back from that experience having learned something, maybe even stronger? There's some research looking, especially with people who have experienced traumatic experience, called post-traumatic growth. That not that we would ever wish trauma on somebody, but that some people out of the depths of those traumatic experiences grow and come out even stronger than they were before. So the idea is, by helping people focus on meaning in life and do it in an interpersonal context, these are two potential ways that people can learn how to overcome challenges in the future.
And just going back to that, something you mentioned about loss and bereavement, it's something that a lot of older adults really struggle with navigating. Why do you think bereavement poses such a profound mental health challenge for older adults?
Yeah. No, it's an excellent question. And what's interesting is that sometimes, and I've been in situations clinically where we know that somebody is going to lose somebody, and we expect that it's just going to be devastating for them. And then we find it's not. And in part, as we think about it, the older we get, the more experiences we accumulate. And also, as we know, the more losses we're going to accumulate. So many older adults will have lost loved ones, they'll have lost parents, they might have lost siblings, they might have lost uncles, aunts, friends, neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. So I've certainly worked with, and I think everybody's worked with older adults, has worked with somebody saying, everybody I knew just about, everyone I grew up with, everybody who knew me as a young person, everyone I worked with is gone. I'm the last one. And you can really get a sense of just how alone they might feel. The flip side of that is, some say, the people of my generation are gone. However, I've been developing relationships with younger people. And so I still have other people who are there for me and who look up to me and who, you know, are happy to help me. But aside from that, and to the point that you're making, for some, loss later in life can be especially overwhelming, especially if this is one of those relationships that, and not to minimize it by any means, but relationships can also be like those sort of meaningful keystones that if, and we think of especially older couples where, you know, they're one another's universe, or can be in some cases, whether they don't have kids or kids moved away or, you know, for whatever reason, they're there around each other all the time, supporting each other, being there for one another, closest friend, confidant, as well as love relationship. And if something happens, if they have a loss of that person, that can really feel insurmountable. And certainly for many people, losing a spouse, losing a loved one like that is a loss. And you know, it's nice to say that in the few people are no longer saying, for the most part, well, a loss that we quote unquote get over. It's recognizing that no, that relationship isn't something you get over. That loss is always going to be that loss. The question is, are you able to shift to accommodate other relationships in your life so that, you know, the time that you would have spent with that person isn't again now spent either sitting on a couch or fully experiencing emotional pain, but recognizing that some of those relationships, and in some cases it could be the relationship of with the next generation, a parent who loses a child or grandchild. In some cases, that can be an even harder one to experience than loss of a spouse or a loved one of similar age. And we think about one of the concepts we talk about is sort of on time and off time. So a 20-year-old retiring, for the most part, is considered off time or before time. A 65-year-old retiring, considered generally on time. A 95-year-old retiring, maybe beyond time. But, you know, we tend to think that there's a certain time for everything. Sounds almost biblical now, but the same is true of loss. And, you know, being in one's 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and losing a spouse doesn't make it any less painful, but it's something that is a little bit more expected because it's sort of in the natural course of things. Losing a child or a grandchild is not considered within the natural course of things. And those losses can be especially overwhelming for people. So, I mean, but the other way of looking at it is experiencing pain as a result of loss is an indication that somebody has loved and that it's part and parcel of living as a human being. We can try growing through life without feeling connection and attachment and love for others. And then maybe their loss won't affect us quite as much. But what sort of life have we been living if we don't have those experiences? So in part, it does amount to taking a risk or allowing ourselves to be vulnerable by loving and experiencing that closeness to others, because we know those relationships can eventually end, whether in death or otherwise. But that there's so much to be gained and so much meaning to be found in those relationships that it's worth it. And that's, you know, part of how we find meaning in those losses, coming to appreciate, enjoy, recognize, remember, and remind others of those who we have had in our lives.
I think one other aspect of grief that makes it particularly challenging is the stigma attached to grief as well, and how there's almost a societal denial of death and loss. And that stigma can make the whole experience of grief a very alienating one, especially for older adults.
And, you know, again, maybe stereotypically, other cultures, other societies, certainly European societies, as well as Asian and some African societies, there's seems to be more of a deeper appreciation of death as being a part of life and an acknowledgement that by virtue of living, we are going to experience death, others, eventually our own, and that's part and parcel of life. And it's nothing necessarily to be run away from. And I don't think you have to be a psychoanalyst to say, this is my way of saying death doesn't bother me, that I can get rid of you. Then again, some people might argue that people go into the field of suicidology also in a way trying to gain some sort of mastery over death. The other reason is to help those who are hurt.
Just to end our discussion today, I wanted to focus on how we can really challenge the pervasive ageist norms that have such a detrimental impact on the mental health of older adults, and how we can really foster that sense of intergenerational solidarity and do more to include older adults into society.
I can be flip and say you've just answered your own question. I think that is it. I think, you know, as long as we continue these pervasive notions of aging being bad, having anti-aging everything, that the normal experiences we have getting older, including changes to our bodies, to our, psychologically, to our lives, et cetera, that by pathologizing aging, we're contributing to the problem. And that by shifting to acknowledge not only that we all get older, but that we'll be very fortunate to do so, and that older adults are a wonderful, not just part of our society, but also a wonderful resource that, quite frankly, you would be silly not to try and tap into or learn from somebody who has tremendous life experience, who's been there before, who's seen it, who recognizes, mistakes we're about to make, and maybe can give us some sage advice to avoid some of the pain that we're about to bring ourselves to. And I think you're right. I think at the family level, that's one of the key ways of doing it. That, encouraging children to want to see their grandparents and or great-grandparents, to want to be around older people, to not make dismissive or negativistic comments about older adults and so on. I've said for years, and maybe it's time, I've always said somebody should, maybe it should be me or others, write a book called something like Gray is Great, that getting older, having gray hair, having white hair, having wrinkles is not a problem. It's in fact maybe a sign of a life well lived. It's a sign of wisdom gained. It's that sort of thing. It's certainly a sign of our time on the planet, and that, hopefully somewhere along the way we learn something from it. And I will say, without saying who, that a close family member of mine, when I grew my beard over the last year, said, well, you can actually go out and get some hair dye, and you can, why would I do that? Why would I, emphasize, not that I'm overemphasizing, but why would I not acknowledge who I am, where I am, and that's simply it. So, and of course we see that, and we see that in society, we see that in some celebrities, we've seen that, recently over the last number of years in a well-known Canadian news figure who had the courage to go gray on TV in front of all of us. And how maybe some people said, why wouldn't she dye our hair? And others have said, fantastic, how courageous, and let's take that as a role model for how we can all be. That getting older doesn't necessarily mean dying. Eventually it will, but that's true for everybody. That getting older can still mean being vibrant, having value, finding and contributing to meaning in life for oneself and others. And I think that, we just need more stories along those lines. And we need to think about, rather than an anti-aging society, we need to be a pro-aging society.
Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Heisel.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you for the excellent questions.